Good evening, and welcome to the Higher Dimensions. This is Phyllis Pricer, your hostess for the evening. And I have with me a lovely guest, a special guest, Dr. Edgar Mitchell, the former astronaut who stepped foot on the moon, one of the few men to do so in our lifetime. Welcome, Dr. Mitchell.
Hello there. Thank you. Nice to be with you.
Dr. Mitchell has written a book. I think you might have heard of it. For those of you who listen to other shows on BBS, it's The Way of the Explorer. It's not his only book, but I think it's your most recent book, is it not, Doctor?
Yes, it's a revision. It's a paperback edition of a previous book, but I've written several, yes.
Oh, good. Well, to give our guests, our audience, listening audience, I'll get the words right out of my mouth this time. In 1971, you went into space, and you were the sixth man to walk on the moon, and the Apollo 14 mission was NASA's third manned lunar landing, and you came back safely on February 9th in 1971, and once you left that program, well, you have a PhD in aeronautics and astronautics as well, if I'm not mistaken, yes.
Yeah.
And you're a graduate from the U.S. Naval Postgraduate Academy. And you've had many awards, including the Presidential Medal of Freedom. And you have retired from the Navy in 72. You also founded the Institute of Noetic Sciences to sponsor research into the nature of consciousness as it relates to cosmology and causality. And in 84, you were a co-founder of the Association of Space Explorers, an international organization of those who experience space travel. And you're also the founder of Quantrek, Inc., which is a nonprofit research organization promoting cutting-edge research to provide a better understanding of the ultimate nature of reality. You've also written The Psychic Exploration, The Way of the Explorer, 1990, and the revised edition as we have now, etc. And you have been spending most of your time, the last 35 years, studying human consciousness and psychic and paranormal phenomena in order to find a common ground between space and spirit. And I've read your book, as I mentioned earlier. You've done a whale of a job, quite frankly. I don't know.
Well, thank you. That's pretty kind of you.
It's very, very interesting that you have chosen to come from a scientific intellectual approach to bringing together the two, because it, I guess, it has long been termed or long been known or decided by many that science and religion or spirituality, should I say, should not be against each other, but really come together in the final analysis. Is that what you're finding?
Well, that's quite true. And the ancients had their take on it, and as modern science has matured over the last 400 years, mm-hmm. And been able to address more and more factual approaches to reality, mm-hmm. we find they're coming together, and that's what this is all about.
Okay. And you have you've done a lot of traveling and a lot of what I call a hands-on experience yourself, going into finding the different states. Basically, I'm not sure what our listeners do know, but that you had sort of a mystical experiential experience. What can experience be but experiential? When you were reentering the atmosphere from space. Would you please tell our listeners about that?
Well, it was actually on the way home, before we reentered the atmosphere. But it turns out it's not so uncommon. It's been recorded in history, which is what I found out. But basically, the experience was was on the way home after I had really completed most of my heavy work, because I was the lunar module pilot and therefore responsible for the lunar spacecraft and the lunar surface activity. So when that was completed and we were on the way home with a well-functioning spacecraft, I could be a little bit of a tourist and enjoy the scenery. And what happened when I did that, after we started home, was that suddenly I realized, and this came from my days at Harvard and MIT, studying astronomy, doing my doctoral work, I realized that the molecules in my body, in the molecules in the spacecraft, and in my partner's bodies had been prototyped and created in some ancient generation of stars. That's where matter is formed.
Mm-hmm.
And suddenly, instead of it being an intellectual awareness, it was a visceral awareness,
mm-hmm.
very powerful, accompanied by an ecstasy and a bliss, that joy that I had never, ever experienced before.
Mm-hmm.
And so my question was, okay, what's this really all about? What do I do about this? And I just observed, and let me set it up in that we were on the way home, we were rotating to keep thermal balance on the spacecraft from the sun, and what that caused to have happen was every 2 minutes, as we rotated, you'd get a picture of the Earth, the Moon, the Sun, and a 360-degree panorama of the heavens.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really an awesome experience,
mm-hmm.
because in space you see the stars and the heavenly bodies 10 times as bright as you can on Earth because of the lack of intervening atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just an overwhelming perspective. So I was looking at that when this occurred, and had this experience that seemed like a unity, and I realized that we humans have been asking these questions about who are we, how do we get here, and what's this really all about,
mm-hmm.
forever, since we've been
on this earth plane, so to
been
speak.
Around and asking these types of questions, and I realized that perhaps now that we were a spacefaring civilization, maybe we ought to re-ask these questions since we had a different perspective. And furthermore, that our science, our answer to these questions about who are we and how did we get here and what's this really all about, in science was probably incomplete and perhaps flawed.
Mm-hmm.
And the answers from our cultural cosmologies, normally rooted in religion, was perhaps archaic. And maybe flawed,
mm-hmm.
and needed re-examination, and that the difference between those two was really centered on why are we conscious at all? What is consciousness? Where does it come from? How is it? How does it evolve? And what's this really all about? So that was kind of what spurred me to then looking at these very deep questions about what is really the nature of our consciousness. And when I got back home, I started looking, because it's such a powerful experience, I started looking through the literature and find nothing in the science
really?
Literature and nothing in the religious literature that described this, and finally enlisted the aid of some scholars over at a nearby university, at Rice University in Houston, to help me find out what was this all about.
Mm-hmm.
And they came up very shortly with the out of the Sanskrit of ancient India over 5,000 years ago, the description of seeing things in their separateness with your eyes, but experience them viscerally, internally, subjectively,
mm-hmm.
as a oneness and accompanied by ecstasy. And that was called a Salvakalpa Samadhi experience, and I'd never heard of that, but that's what they brought to me. And so having that as kind of the background, I went ahead and started doing my work and all those sorts of things. But I then started asking the questions from scholars around the world and mystical people and religious leaders from all different cultures, like the kahuna of the South Pacific,
mm-hmm.
shamans, medicine men of the Indian tribes, and so forth, and found that in every culture, and the ancient cultures and their mystical lore and in their tradition were something akin to this experience, which they described, a transformational type experience.
Mm-hmm.
And so I suddenly realized that the experiences were very common in we humans, dating back to ancient history, but the descriptions of what really went on was rooted in our cultural language and our beliefs. And so our descriptions of what was going on was quite different. And from culture to culture, and we tend to argue over and fight over who's got the best description, who's got the best God. But nevertheless, experience is the same experience.
Right, exactly.
So that was fundamentally the experience. Fundamentally what I have been practicing for the last 35 years is learning how to bring the tools of science to understand these types of experiences.
Ed, from reading your book, what I understand is that you can achieve this through what I would call the intellectualizing or use of the mind, rather than have it just become a sporadic, mystical, sometimes thing. Is that correct?
Well, you broke up a little bit. I didn't quite...
Okay, I said sometimes that you found that you could utilize your mind to bring on these particular experiences, these transformational or mystical experiences.
Yes, we have learned in recent times, of course, the ancient traditions have always used a meditation procedure, and that's been the core of the ancient traditions, and
right.
That certainly works. But in modern times, we learned how to augment that a little bit with modern technologies like biofeedback and certain type of breathing procedures that help bring out these types of experiences as well.
And, so you think the mystical procedures that have been ordinarily assigned to special people really indeed are something that's inherent to mankind?
Yeah, it is just inherent in our culture and in the nature of life itself as we understand it.
Okay. So that anyone could, through proper training, access these mystical or enhanced awarenesses, as I might call it.
Well, yes. And certainly there are many training courses out now purporting to help do that and help people perceive and gain control of their inner experience. That's been growing here over the last 30 years or so quite profoundly. It's quite interesting to watch all this work.
It sort of kind of validates what you've been researching all these years, yes?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Being an explorer. It's an innovator and a new way of looking at it. Because so many people, even today, I think, feel that the mystical experience is really a part of the unknowable and just special people have it, when in truth it is something that is inherent to all humans.
Yes, that's very true. Yeah.
Okay. And why do you think that people assigned it to such a certain... awesome, I will use that word, awesome, area, and would allow or say that only certain people could achieve this goal?
Well, I think that's part of the rooted in the many cultures of our past where the leaders and the mystical people and the spiritual leaders of whatever culture got politicized and it becomes a power struggle. And we find in all of our cultures that our deepest traditions tend to be politicized in whatever way we politicize them in that culture. And
is it considered then that powerful a tool?
I'm sorry, please.
The common person, as they would put it, the lay person, if you want to put it another way, to have access to, and so it was a matter of, because people were put to death who had these gifts.
Well, that's quite true. It's been like so many other of our talents. It gets rooted in ego and self-aggrandizement instead of for the betterment of the greater good, which these things are, in my opinion, are supposed to be.
Exactly.
And which transcendental experiences and transformational experiences normally put one on the path of seeking the greater good. Yeah.
Okay. And you feel that these experiences are indeed for the greater good. Your take on it, I find, is interesting because it is not rooted in religion, but it is rooted in the evolution of the species.
That's right. That's exactly right. And What has helped us? What is one of the new stuff that we've learned is that our evolutionary process, whereas since the beginning of evolution theory back with Darwin in the previous two centuries, over 150 years ago, we thought that evolution was a random process, just random events causing changes in the culture. Turns out that's not true. It's a learning process, even in nature. Nature learns, and that's the...
Well, yeah.
That's one of the profound lessons that's come out of all of this also.
Okay. Well, I would say if we didn't learn, we wouldn't survive, would we?
No.
That's kind of
but
self-evident.
It's not only we, it's nature and...
Yes.
It's most inanimate forms is a learning mechanism also, of course.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I have to agree with that. Each to his or to its own sphere of growth. What do you think compiles or separates us from evolution or other species, or say the difference between a rock and a human being, say?
Well, let's take it a step at a time here. The studies in consciousness that I have done and colleagues have done in recent years, particularly in the area of quantum mechanics and quantum physics, suggest to us that the perception itself, the very thing that we call perception or awareness, and awareness is the most basic definition of consciousness. When you're aware, you're conscious. I mean, that's in the English language, those words go together.
Uh-huh.
And we have for almost 80 years since the discovery of quantum mechanics, that most modern aspect of studying the physics of nature, we have used the word when we talk about particles
okay.
that become entangled. Entanglement is mm-hmm. one of the aspects of the quantum world. There's four aspects of the quantum world that are very descriptive, and that's entanglement, correlation, non-locality, and resonance.
Mm-hmm.
And what we have said is that when quantum particles or particles at the subatomic level are entangled and they go across the universe from each other, they remain coherent, and if you do something to one, the other one responds. And for most of that time, we have used quotation marks around the word know and says that one particle knows what its partner is doing.
Yes, yes. I read a little bit, and I do mean just a very little bit, about the fact that the science was so surprised that when they affected an atom in one area, its counterpart was affected elsewhere.
Exactly. Well, let's, for the sake of discussion and argument here, take away those quotation marks and say that that is the very beginning, that non-local entanglement
mm-hmm.
is the very beginning of knowing that at that level, at the level of photons and subatomic matter
mm-hmm.
that becomes entangled in the quantum world, that indeed what we say we know,
mm-hmm.
It implies that we're entangled in that way. And it's been demonstrated experimentally many, many times now over the last 30 or 40 years that not only are quantum particles or subatomic particles entangled, but you move up the scale of a living substance to simple bacteria and plants and very simple life forms,
mm-hmm.
and you put them in a Faraday cage,
mm-hmm.
Faraday cage, which is a particular device that screens out electromagnetic signaling. But
sort of like lead, if I'm not mistaken.
Beg your pardon?
Like lead? Something like a lead casing or something like
yeah,
that?
Yeah, well, it's a screen.
Okay.
A screen, yes, that is grounded, that doesn't permit electromagnetic signaling like radio waves or television waves to go through.
Right, okay.
But it does allow these types of signals to go through and allows gravity to go through. Gravity can't be screened and these quantum signals can't be screened.
Right, okay.
So, that's been now known for quite a few years. And it seems that, for example, if you even take plants and you put some inside a screened cage and hook them up to electrodes, and you do something like love one batch and the ones inside the screen will react, or you threaten them like burning them, or the ones inside the screen will react to it.
Yes.
And that takes place at all levels of very simple matter.
Right.
And then you move on up the scale of complexity to animals with brains, and you find that they are become self-aware. They recognize themselves as distinct from the environment that they're in.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then you come on up the scale of complexity to our level, and not only are we self-aware, but we can think about our thinking. We're self-reflectively aware.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't know how many more levels of brain and conscious development can take place, but we do know we can go through several levels just with our own capabilities. And anyhow, using those notions, we realize that this field of quantum mechanics that's been around in our science only since the early part of the 20th century, we're now being able to realize that it helps us understand consciousness in a way that we never have understood it before.
Mm-hmm.
And that's pretty exciting stuff. It really is.
Okay. The other thing that I have in mind is, what about free will?
I didn't hear that. Try again.
What about free will? Where would that come in? Where we can consciously make choices to either do something that is, say, helpful and for the good of all concerned, or not, as the case may be.
Well, I think it's... I'm sorry, I'm having a little trouble hearing you, but I think your question right.
Okay.
We do have choice. There's no doubt about it. The fact is, I use the following phrase to describe the type of universe we're in.
Mm-hmm.
We're in a universe that is intelligent, creative, self-organizing, learning, trial and error, interactive, non-locally interconnecting, by information, evolutionary system. And it takes all of those attributes to explain exactly what kind of a universe we're really in. And it's pretty profound, the type of universe that we're in.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no question but that our mental processes very dramatically influence what goes on in nature around us. Now,
absolutely, yes.
Now, to help understand, between the ancient thinking that goes back to Plato and before in the
mm-hmm.
early Greek times, between the notions of the idealist system in which consciousness is the only stuff,
uh-huh.
and matter is an illusion, to the other extreme of the scientific materialism, which consciousness is simply an epiphenomenon of molecular structure.
Hmm.
Those two extremes, I think, are both wrong, and that the truth lies somewhere in between.
Mm-hmm.
And we cannot demonstrate, or we can demonstrate, that both of those extremes are not correct, but we still don't know exactly where in the middle it comes together, and that's what research is really all about these days.
And... in your exploration, do you find that with the growth and the extension of learning that a greater percentage of the brain is used, there is
there's an awful lot of work yet to be done in
okay.
the in the area of neurophysiology and brain studies
uh-huh.
to truly understand exactly what part of the brain is used and how much of this goes beyond brain. We know brain is not the only aspect of it, but it's fairly important aspect.
Right.
And Carl Pribram.
I was going to say, and that memory is not only located in the brain, but it's located in other parts of the body.
Well, it's located in the body, and
yes.
it turns out it's located outside of the body also.
Yes.
In what we're now calling the zero-point energy field.
Okay.
Which is the that part of nature that pervades all free space and... seems to have enough energy to create the entire universe all over again.
Okay.
Yep. Well, that's what our current studies would suggest, is that the zero-point energy field is of great fundamental importance to that we don't really understand at all yet exactly how everything fits together at this point.
Okay, and you could call 0 point for you for our listeners is what?
I'm sorry, I didn't get that.
0 point for our, could you explain what 0 point is for our listeners?
Okay, the 0 point comes from the fact. The 0 point comes from the fact that it was discovered by Max Planck over 100 years ago that all matter emits and reabsorbs energy. And that's called black body radiation. And Max Planck first investigated that. In later years, we've come to understand it a great deal better. And I'm sorry, I kind of lost my train of thought here.
You were talking about the 0 point and the discussion.
Okay, yes. For this all comes together, is that we know that if we reduce matter to absolute 0 degrees Kelvin in a vacuum chamber, and it still emits and reabsorbs energy, even though molecular motion changes and essentially ceases at that
right.
level of temperature. But the emission and reabsorption of energy takes place continuously. Well, one of the more recent discoveries is that if you, one of a colleague of mine in Europe, Dr. Walter Schimpf, is that if you study these emissions from any physical object as a group as opposed to just simply individual emissions.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll help get this idea across this way, that if you look at the swirl on your finger,
right,
it doesn't tell you much about you.
Mm-hmm.
But if you look at the pattern of swirls on all 10 fingertips, that's your fingerprints, and it uniquely identifies you.
Right.
So studying those swirls or those fingerprints as a group tells you something unique about this physical object we call the body.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Dr. Schimpf discovered from his studies that this was true of all of the black body radiation from any object. He was trying to improve MRI machines, and he discovered that if you study the black body radiation from each and every object, it carries unique information non-locally about that object. And that was quite a while. We've only known that now for about 14 or 15 years. And it provides an entirely new perspective of most everything. It's a whole new approach to biology and to science that utilizes, well, from mystical lore of centuries ago, the ancients called, had a word for the history of the universe and recorded in the so-called Akashic record. That was,
oh yes,
that was their word for nature's memory. Well,
right.
It turns out that this quantum hologram precisely does what the ancients said the Akashic record was. It provides the mechanism for that to happen.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so that's quite an interesting modern development that harkens back to ages-old approaches to things.
Okay. But that still didn't quite answer my question about free will.
Okay, that's right. We've got off
it. Go ahead.
Well, the whole point is we do have choice.
Right.
Coming out of determinism of classical science said that all matter in the universe is on prescribed trajectories operating under the laws of physics, and that if you ever once knew, in principle, all the positions of all the molecules in the universe, you would know where they are forever, and therefore there's no choice, and mind has nothing to do with it. It's just an illusion. Well, that is the deterministic aspect,
right,
that says that mind and consciousness is just an epiphenomenon of material structure. Well,
okay.
I don't believe that, and neither does anybody else at this point. That has really understood what we're talking about here.
Uh-huh.
But that's one of the extremes that I say in my analyzing it between idealism and strict materialism.
Okay.
That's the extreme that's not valid either. But without that, you see, we now have enough evidence to show that choosing has an effect on physical reality.
Well, yes.
And our choices may not totally determine reality because the laws of physics do operate, but it's an interactive system, as I said in my earlier remarks, that that mind that does interact with nature and matter and has effect, and that that's so much for free will. That's what it is.
Okay. It's interesting because you would think that people would get it, wouldn't you?
Well, these are pretty deep subjects that philosophers and theologians and scientists have been arguing about for several hundred years now.
Oh,
and particularly with the role of science, it's kind of changed the game a little bit in the last 400 years.
Well, it certainly has gone from an Earth that is lives or is balanced on the back of a turtle.
Yeah.
to being burned, threatened to be burned at the stake if you believe the Earth revolved around the sun rather than the sun around the Earth.
Well,
so
that was kind of the last of that. Fortunately, that was one of the good things that Rene Descartes did almost 400 years ago. Was as a cardinal of the prince of the church, came to the conclusion that the body, mind, and physicality, spirituality, were separate things that didn't interact. Now, he turned out to be wrong, but it did get the Inquisition off the backs of the intellectuals 400 years ago, and they quit burning them at the stake because they disagreed with the church, as long as they stayed away from mind, consciousness, and spirituality.
Right.
And so it's only been here in the last 80 years or so, with the advent of quantum mechanics, that we realized mind and matter do interact, and started to use those tools to help us understand far more about this thing we call consciousness.
Yes, yes. You know what I also found interesting is that, and this is a little bit off the subject, but that there is no such thing as true objectivity in research
I'm
now.
I'm sorry, I didn't quite get that.
That there is no such thing as truly true objectivity when someone is studying a subject in a scientific manner, because our very thoughts interact, as you say, or react upon that which is being studied, and so it can alter it.
Well, all of our observations, everything we do inside ourselves is truly subjective. We don't observe objectively. We observe, and then if enough of us agree on something, we would call that an objective observation.
Or consensus.
That's what science is all about, is to use the tools of science and experiment and measurement to test and replicate something until everybody agrees that's an answer. And then we're still wrong sometimes.
Yeah, sometimes we still are, but then that's what time gives us, right? The opportunity to correct our mistakes or to experience new highs, whichever. What I was going to ask you too is, please feel free at this moment to, since we're into the show and I meant to start this at the beginning, to give your website and where you can book to be obtained.
Yes, my personal website is edmitchellapollo14.com, numerals, edmitchellapollo14.com. And my the Institute of Noetic Sciences website, which I founded 35 years ago to study these effects, is noetic, noetic.org. Noetic, noetic.org.
Mm-hmm.
And then a recent foundation that we're getting going at this point to look more at the hard sciences, the physics, the biology, the chemistry of these type problems,
mm-hmm.
Which is not quite in the realm of noetics, mm-hmm. but parallel to what we're doing in noetics. That organization is called Quantrek, and the website is quantrek.org, and it has some pretty fascinating ideas on it, and some pretty interesting, my team has some pretty interesting people have done some very wonderful work in these areas.
Well, that's fascinating. You must have made a lot of contacts throughout the world, because I understand that you do team with people from around the world to in the different disciplines to study these effects, so that you approach it not just from one point of view, but from several points of view.
Yes. We don't have dogma at this point in our studies. We're looking for how are things put together, and fully recognizing that every so often, every few perhaps centuries or even more frequently, that our whole mind, our whole take on what the universe is all about undergoes a fairly major shift. And as a matter of fact, it looks like we're about to encounter one of those right now.
Really?
And we're really in the process of watching this taking place. And it's particularly as it pertains to much of our understanding of what we can do to create a sustainable civilization. I'm sure many of our listeners recognize that we're in pretty deep trouble as far as much of civilization is concerned,
mm-hmm.
simply because we have outgrown much of our thinking. We've outgrown, and our population has exploded. I like to point out that there's over 6.5 billion people on this planet at this time, and over half of them weren't even born when I went to the moon 37 years ago.
Yeah, I've noticed things are getting a little crowded on the roads here.
Yes, it's getting a little crowded in certain places.
I'm sure it's probably going to get crowded up in space before long, too.
It will be, and if we don't quit throwing junk up there, it's going to be too polluted up in space to be able to fly up there much more. But also, space does have some assets and some benefits for our future, for the civilization to learn to better ourselves and to use those tools to create a more sustainable civilization. Big pardon?
Do you envision from what you have studied and that man will one day move to having space stations or find other planets that we can people, as it were?
Well, I don't have any doubt in due course that will happen.
Okay.
But if you want to look at it in a very long-range point of view, this is very long-range.
Okay.
You have to recognize that our planetary system has a finite lifetime. Our sun has a finite lifetime.
Right.
And it will burn out here in another. It's about halfway through its lifetime. Now, of course, its lifetime is about 10 billion years, so we're only about halfway through it.
But we shouldn't be ready to pack up
a little time left.
We shouldn't really pack up and ready to leave tomorrow, then.
I don't think we need to rush out tomorrow and run away, no.
Okay.
But in due course, we're going to have to do that. And so recognizing that we live on a finite planet and that it has a lifetime like everything else in the universe that we know, and sooner or later, we will have to leave this planet.
Uh-huh.
And I'm sure that that's our destiny. We will continue to go out further, out into the universe, exploring our solar system.
Mm-hmm.
And perhaps, and I've written a paper in the physics journals that would suggest that at the end of this century, we might even be able to go outside our solar system if we don't blow ourselves up in the process.
Let's not go there.
Beg your pardon?
Let us not go there. I'd like to keep the optimistic point of view that there will be enough of us with common sense that will not be an option.
I would like to think that's true. I would like to hope that's true. Sure.
Seems like an awful waste of a lot of energy to go around doing that to oneself.
Yes, but we have been doing it for quite a few thousands of years to each other and wasting our resources. And it's become critical in our civilization. I like to tell the story, if I may. That to help get the point across.
Sure, go ahead.
My great-grandparents came across from the south of the United States at the end of the Civil War to start a new life in the West in the cattle business. And they crossed in a covered wagon pulled by horses with a few head of cattle. And railroads had not been completed across the south and the west at that point. And Automobiles certainly hadn't been invented. Light bulbs hadn't been invented. And my father was born just shortly after the Wright brothers flew the first airplane flight.
Isn't that cool?
And I went to the moon. So
amazing. Look at
so
that.
So from covered wagons to going to the moon in less than 100 years, 1870s to 1969.
Isn't that amazing?
Is a pretty rapid change of things going on, of development. And it hadn't slowed down. And
why do you think that is at this time and place?
Science and technology that really began to mushroom at the end of the 19th century.
Why did it suddenly percolate at that point?
Well, it took over 100 years for the Industrial Revolution, and before that, the period of the Enlightenment, and before that, the fall of the Roman Empire and Western civilization to be revamped. Those things took a couple of hundred years each.
Mm-hmm.
But with the development of new science and technologies, extending life expectancy, and all of that taking place in this last 150 years,
mm-hmm.
everything has gotten out of control. We've simply outreached, overgrown our population. We have...
Isn't there an inherent self-correction in nature, shall we say?
Well, we'll find that out. We haven't seen one yet.
I think that has, if I remember some of my early history correctly, that there have been times when there's been a lot of population and a lot of turmoil, that a natural self-correction, if you would care to determine that, takes place usually through what we would call natural disasters?
Well, it could happen, of course. But I don't think we could count on that because we
have... Well, no, it's better. We shouldn't have to.
Because this is one we have mostly created ourselves.
Right.
And as we look back, we should be intelligent enough to know that we've created it, and we should be able to do something about it. Now, the real question is, are we going to do that? And
what do you think causes people to make the same mistakes over and over again?
Beg your pardon?
What do you think it is that causes some humans, to keep making the same mistake over and over again? It's though... what was that old quote? Those who do not study history are doomed to live it?
No, repeat it.
Sorry. You're right. Correct.
Well, Max Planck pointed out also 100 years ago, at the same time he was discovering black body radiation about that time, that progress isn't made by convincing skeptics, but funeral by funeral.
Ah.
And we seem to do that, too. We make our progress by... not by changing our minds, but as the old guard dies off and the new guard comes on to take over and do things differently.
Well, sometimes they tend to repeat themselves.
Beg your pardon?
Sometimes they tend to repeat themselves.
Well, that's quite often. But
which
one
I
of
find sad.
One of the things that's happening here, well, that happens on a small scale, but one of the things that's happening in our time is that the growth of our consumption to be a world civilization is changing the order of things considerably.
Okay.
And so we have to consider that it's our world civilization that's really strongly impacting the way things are at this point.
I see. And what do you think are some of the possible steps that might be taken to assist in correcting this?
Well, we certainly know we're going to have to do something about energy supplies that... our fossil fuels are nearing the end, close to the end of their cycle. And
okay.
So we're going to have to replace them with something else.
What about the renewable source of energy from, say, the solar energy or that type of thing?
What energy, please?
Solar energy.
Oh, well, we've got a lot of alternatives. Using the sun's energy more effectively is certainly a powerful way that needs to be explored and needs to be utilized.
Mm-hmm.
But we've been, for the last... See, remember, we've only been using fossil fuels, like oil from underground, for about the last 130 years. And
right.
In this 130 or 40 years, we're about to use up all the known resources.
Which is pretty pathetic, quite
That's
frankly.
Pretty darn pathetic is exactly right. But we do have to replace that or with something new... And there's a lot of study going on, an enormous amount of study. And one of the possible sources is this the zero-point energy field that exists.
Oh, really?
Oh, yes.
And now, how would that be of use in a resource?
Well, we now know from quantum mechanics that there's enough energy in this zero-point energy field to create the whole universe. That's where all of our matter came from in the first place.
Okay.
And we don't know yet how to properly extract that and utilize it.
Okay.
But that's one of the major studies that's going on in several quarters right now to help define our energy problems better. Our solutions to our energy problems.
Okay. Now, going back to prehistory times, when we have stories of the use of solar energy from, say, prior civilizations, do you think there were prior civilizations that had a better understanding and use of the energy that abounds in the Earth, like solar energy or other types?
Well, it's possible that some civilizations were more advanced than we have understood, but we don't have a lot of evidence to suggest that. I mean, there's a lot of lore, but there's really not a lot of good evidence to suggest that. But whatever it is, if that is true, they somehow found the ways to wipe themselves out or to terminate their existence. So
well,
they weren't quite as smart as people
well,
might like to give them
given,
the credit.
I would say given the nature of, decomposition, just the nature of decay, would...
I'm sorry, I didn't get that.
I said the nature of decay itself... Wouldn't that be something that would prevent, if it were far enough in the prehistory, that there would be discernible or very obvious abilities that, well, there just wouldn't be any events left because it would have been rotted away, so to speak.
Yeah, I guess I'm not quite with you on that one. I'm not quite.
In other words, things decay over a period of time.
I'm
right,
sorry.
Like wood or mountain. There's earthquakes. There's the changing environment.
Well, we've had extinction events, quite a few extinction events. I'm not sure there's been any that had humanoids really involved. We seem to have come along after most of those took place.
As far as we know, right?
Yeah, most of the extinction events took place early in the formation of the solar system, when there were still a lot of asteroids and solar material floating around banging into things.
Would that be a possibility that would still happen today?
Of course. It's certainly quite possible. There are studies going on to try to help better define and to detect if we are might be subject to a large asteroid impact or large cosmic debris, surely.
Okay. Well, that's a fascinating subject also. I think there are a number of subjects that are really being looked at in today's world from, I think, many standpoints. What I was thinking of is finding out, for example, that there was brain surgery thousands of years ago when they have found some evidence of surgical procedures on skulls, for example, in the New World.
There's certainly, I'm sure there was attempts at surgical procedures. I really question whether how effective that really was on a large scale.
In other words, we didn't even really know about
sterilization and
microbes
and that sort of thing at those periods.
Right, exactly. Although there are some, I guess, natives that believed in bathing quite a bit, which would be, you know, the cleanliness and the cutting down. If they did not understand why they did it, they just knew through trial and error or observational techniques that, you know, that which was that which was clean was less likely to, people were less likely to die if they were around.
I'm sure that there was a lot of conventional wisdom in that area too, yes.
So you are continuing to do the study. What area are you hoping to continue to advance in personally that you want to continue spending your life studying? And where you think it's going to lead you?
Well, all of my studies now are frontier studies, but they're hopefully designed to help create a more sustainable civilization for us. so that we can get past this period of damaging our environment and being unable to properly connect it. I've been lecturing on this subject for almost 30 years now, that knowing that this was coming upon us, and so everything I do is oriented toward understanding how we can best understand ourselves. And for example, let me remind you that at the beginning of the space age, which was only 50 years ago, that Sputnik went up and, on October the 4th, 1957, so that was just a little over 50 years ago.
It's and amazing, isn't it?
It is. And think about the fact that our knowledge of ourselves, our understanding of the heavens, was about as sophisticated in those times as God in the heavens, man in the middle, and everything else below. That was just about all we knew.
Right.
Telescopes had not really progressed to where we are today by any means. And the Hubble that we have up there right now has been providing utterly amazing new insights and photos to the distant heavens. So back 50 years ago, we really didn't know much about our universe. Today, we're starting to gain quite a pretty good knowledge of it, and that's quite different than what we thought in those days. And
it's remarkable. It's absolutely remarkable.
Finding ourselves and finding our place in the universe is really entering a new phase, and that's why I'm quite confident that in our time frame of the next 20 or 30 years, there will be a fairly major shift in the way we perceive ourselves and our responsibilities to keeping this planet alive, well, and going.
Oh, that's fantastic. Well, Doctor, we're coming near to the time when we have to say goodbye, but I'd like you once again to please provide your information, your contact information again, to our listening audience.
I'll be glad to. It's edmitchellapollo14.com is my personal website. That's, of course, www.edmitchellapollo14.com. My Institute of Noetic Sciences, N-O-E-T-I-C, it's noetic.org, and that has some valuable information on the institute I founded 35 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And the newer frontier science operation is called Quantrek, Quantrek.org, and you'll find all of those websites with a lot of interesting material for yourself.
And, well, again, I want to take this opportunity to say thank you so much. It's been a very enlightening, and it's been a lot of fun. I've learned some things, and I've been so fascinated to look at mankind and spirituality, in a sense, from a standpoint that I had not looked at it before.
Well,
and I want to thank you very much for all the work you have done for mankind in all of these years.
It's been a great pleasure to be with you. Thank you very much.
God bless you, and good night, sir.
Goodbye, Manny.
All right. Good night, everyone, and we'll talk to you next week. I wish you all a very, very happy Easter, and I am looking forward to talking to you again. I will be your hostess, and I will be doing readings next week or giving past lives, whatever you would like to talk about next week. I look forward to hearing from you, and feel free to contact me at BBS Radio or my website, psychicworlds4@AOL.com, or I can reach at area code 202-387-2080. God bless you and good night.